DW.
Well, I have to say that when I think about being with him in the same room, which was last autumn when I wrote our first sort of big Business Week cover story on his race and who he is, the thing that sticks out in my mind is realizing when I was sitting down with him that he had pictures of himself on his left, on the wall on his left. He had pictures of himself in front of him. He had pictures of himself behind him. And I think he may have even had pictures of himself to his right on his fourth side. And he definitely had a gun above him. That's the image that sticks in my head. This is a guy who clearly loves himself. And I'm not sure I've ever met anyone quite like him.
Let's get into the money. Nobody would dispute that he's a billionaire. All right, I've seen some say $8 billion. He himself says $10 billion. Forbes says $4.5 billion. According to your accounting, Max, what is it?
You know, I happen to sit next to, in the newsroom, just a terrific reporter named Caleb Melby. And what Caleb is so good at as a reporter is figuring out how much people are worth. Because on the one hand, people like to sometimes pretend that they're not billionaires so they can hide their wealth. Obviously, people use shell corporations to hide their wealth, as we've seen over the last year. But on the other hand, there are people like Donald Trump who try to exaggerate their wealth. And so while he goes around saying, I think he says he's worth, what is it, $10 billion? Worth more than $10 billion, he said. Caleb's really, really excellent reporting for what we call here the Bloomberg Billionaires Index shows that he is worth $3 billion as of a couple of months ago. That would be July 2016. That's actually up from $2.9 billion a year ago. And how that breaks down, just so your listeners can understand, is he's got a bunch of golf courses and resorts that are worth about $710 million. He's a landlord of a couple of skyscrapers that don't have the Trump name on it. That's in partnership with a company called Vornado. That's worth about $590 million. And then he owns Trump Tower in 40 Wall Street, which you and I will talk about. That's another billion. And he's a landlord for the Nike Town store. That's another $500 million. So, you know, on the one hand, there's an instinct to think that he's like the richest man in the world, which he just simply isn't. And there's also an instinct to think that, you know, he's really worth nothing, which is also not true. But what I like about my colleague Caleb's reporting is it shows that, you know, while he's rich, he certainly isn't as rich as he says.
I remember as a kid, I mean, we're talking 20 years ago when I was back in Wisconsin, hearing about that enormous fortune that belongs to Donald Trump. Let's go back to the beginning. I mean, he says he built himself up sort of rags to riches style. Is that true?
The fun thing for my first story about him last year is that it was called How Trump Invented Trump. And that's really what we wrote about. You know, on the one hand, he really is self-invented in the sense that he created this image that would reach a little boy in the Midwest where you were, that somehow he was like this incredible all-American hero. That's self-created. What isn't self-created, though, is his fortune. He is the heir to an outer borough real estate developer named Fred Trump. Fred Trump was a complicated guy. He was really sort of a colorful salesman. His company got in trouble with the United States government in the 1960s, I believe it was, for discriminating against black renters or would-be black renters. The Trump organization essentially was accused of turning African Americans down. But Fred Trump definitely had a taste for flair and for salesmanship, selling houses in, I think it was Brooklyn and Queens, I think it was. What Donald Trump did, though, which I wrote about in last year's Business Week story, is that he brought that outer borough empire into Manhattan. And he did that using his father's wealth. And he did that using his father's political connections. His father was very politically connected, and that was really important when Trump got tax breaks on two of his first big projects. So even though, you know, he sort of rails against the global elite, Donald Trump really only exists today thanks to the political connections that he enjoyed that allowed him to get tax breaks on redeveloping something called the Commodore Hotel on 42nd Street, back when 42nd Street was sort of very sleazy and sad. And then, of course, Trump Tower, which I reported on extensively just a month ago.
And so, okay, he started out with real estate. And along the way, he had a number of businesses, right? Were they as successful, Max?
The important thing to know, if you're going to step back and wonder about the business career of the man who is going to be the next president of the United States of America, is that he was really there is no better symbol for the excess of the 1980s than Donald Trump. On the one hand, he wasn't involved in the excesses of alcohol and cocaine that's famous for sort of 1980s business. You know, if you've seen American Psycho, you sort of know that sort of 1980s New York style. Actually, as it happens, one of Trump's brothers died of alcoholism, I believe. And so Donald Trump has claimed that he has never had a drink or a sip of coffee. But he certainly was a symbol of 1980s excess when it comes to debt. And he borrowed extensively. And, you know, he bought one of the biggest yachts in the world. He built these lavish casinos. He bought an airline, and he did it with a lot of borrowed money. And he was also a symbol of the crash that followed the excess of the 1980s. And he is very, very lucky that in the beginning of the 1990s, when his empire unraveled, he is very lucky that he wasn't personally ruined. It's only because bankers sort of believed he was worth more to them alive than dead, worth more, you know, solvent than bankrupt, that Trump didn't actually personally go bankrupt. So rather what happened is that his businesses, I believe it was four of them, went bankrupt, including several of his casinos in Atlantic City. So, you know, he was successful in the 1980s, but in the 90s, he crashed. And what emerged from the wreckage was a very different Donald Trump. And it's much more of the Donald Trump that we know now. Someone who used the media, and someone who used licensing deals, and someone who used a reality TV show to sort of turn him into a very new kind of celebrity and a new kind of tycoon.
Right. And from watching that TV show, The Apprentice, you get a sense that Donald Trump is the god boss, you know, who drinks from the holy grail of business acumen. Did you get a sense from your reporting of how he conducts a business? Can you just sort of break that down for us?
Sure. I mean, I remember one thing I've written is that in the same way he's a politician who is completely post-politics, which is to say, you know, he had no experience in public policy. He had none of the politeness that we associate with politics. In the same way, he's almost a businessman who's post-business because, you know, on the one hand, he shows himself as the world's great negotiator and the world's great businessman. You're hired and you're fired and so on. But on the other hand, he really is a builder who no longer actually builds skyscrapers. If you're in New York City and you're in Central Park and you crane your neck up at the skyline, you'll see an extraordinary amount of garishly tall buildings. Donald Trump hasn't built any of those. He's really been left behind in the race toward the sky in New York. Trump Tower, in a way, is sort of outdated. And of course, most of the buildings that go up with Trump's name around the world are not actually built by him. So, you know, he really he's been able to do something that very few people have been able to do, which is to sell his name on real estate and sort of half pretend that it's his. But he really no longer is a builder in the traditional sense, although he does do things like, for example, there's a hotel in Washington that he's involved in, and his organization is doing that. That's the old post office. And then, you know, he does build things like some resorts. I think he builds a couple of buildings every now and then. But think of him in the same way that he's post-politics. He's also essentially sort of a businessman who's post-business, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, got you. Speaking of those towers right now, I mean, you say in your writing that anyone looking for insight into how Trump will lead the country need look no further than the building he already rules. That is, you know, the Trump building, 40 Wall Street, and the tower, the Trump Tower. You've been in there. So give us a sense. What is it like in there?
That's right. So let's start with Trump Tower. That's really his headquarters. That's where he lives, and it's where he works, and it's where he ran his campaign. It's where he famously took the escalator down to announce his presidential run last year. Feels like so long ago. And what we found in our reporting about Trump Tower is that it's a place that's just, we just simply combed through public records to try to understand who lived in Trump Tower, who his neighbors are, and who his neighbors have been, the people who work there in the offices. And what we found is it's like a microcosm of the Trump world. There's certainly the celebrity side, you know, Michael Jackson and Johnny Carson and Liberace all lived in the building. But then we found gangsters. We found not just gangsters who've been involved in international poker rings and have ties to the Russian mafia, but we found gangsters who have ties to Trump. So, for example, Felix Sater, who helped develop Trump Soho, he worked on the 21st floor. And that was after going to prison for stabbing a man in the face with a broken margarita glass. That was Sater on the 24th floor. Then there was a man named Joseph Wechselbaum, And Wetzelbaum had a helicopter company, and they flew sort of, you know, the fancy customers to Trump casinos. Wetzelbaum lived in Trump Tower after serving prison time for cocaine trafficking. And then, of course, there are people, you know, who haven't gotten in trouble with the law, but are part of Trump's world. Paul Manafort, who quit as Trump's campaign chairman, he's in the building. And then, you know, we found, for example, the FIFA, people connected with the FIFA scandal. Chuck Blazer is currently living in Trump Tower on house arrest after pleading. Chuck Blazer. I apologize. It's Jose Maria Moran who's living in Trump Tower under house arrest. He pleaded not guilty to the soccer bribery charges. Chuck Blazer used to live and used to work in Trump Tower. He's already pled guilty. And one thing that I like, because my name is Max, is I found in my reporting that he kept a macaw in Trump Tower with him. And the macaw's name was Max. So Trump Tower is just a bizarre place. And just quickly, 40 Wall Street, the building he owns downtown, is sort of similar. It's got a lot of you know, it's got a lot of what you would call a boiler room, sort of where people call up strangers and try to get them to buy stocks. In fact, what we found about 40 Wall Street is that there is no other address in the United States that has more of the financial companies, more of the unregistered brokerages that investors complain about than 40 Wall Street. It's just, you know, you can't make it up.
Let me get skin into this quickly with you, Max. One of the main messages that Trump tried to convey throughout his campaign was loyalty, right? The way he treats his people. When he was in Wisconsin at this town hall meeting, I'm going to quote him here, "Folks, I'm loyal. I'm really loyal. I'll be loyal to this country. I'll be loyal to Wisconsin." Max, what is he like with his people?
You know, the one thing you can say about him is that he is a loyal employer, in the sense that when I went to try to see who makes up the Trump Organization, this is what I found. I found that in I think it was around 1980, he was at a tennis game, and there was a semi-pro football player working security. And at the tennis game, it was the U.S. Open, there were hecklers jeering Martina Navratilova. And this football player working security ran up and tackled the hecklers. And Trump was like, "That guy, I want to hire that guy." So he brought that guy on his bodyguard. And then what happened to that bodyguard, his name is Matt Calamari, is that Trump slowly gave him more and more responsibility, until now Calamari is the chief operating officer of the Trump Organization. And then another example, I mentioned Trump's father. Trump's dad's accountant, a man named Allen, is now Trump's chief financial officer. So he certainly is loyal, in the sense that he just sort of picks people and employs people in this sort of whimsical way and then sticks with them. One final example is that there was a teenager, I think she was a waitress at one of his Westchester golf clubs. He found her and said, "You should come work for me after you graduate from college." And she's now, like, you know, helping to oversee a part of the Trump portfolio. I think it has to do with golf marketing. So, you know, you have to answer that the man is loyal when it comes to his odd way of hiring and keeping people.
All right, Max, bottom line here, taking into account the narcissism you mentioned at the top of this interview and sort of the oddities with regard to his businesses, in the face of the absurd division that this election has brought to light in American society, do you think that Trump, the one that you've covered in your writing, has the ability to come through with what he's promising, that he's going to unite Americans, that he's going to be able to listen to advisors and negotiate with world leaders? Is he the guy?
Well, I don't think anyone in the world can say, neither a Trump supporter nor a Clinton supporter can really say what's going to happen when Trump becomes the 45th president of the United States. But as a journalist, what I can talk about is sort of at least what I've seen him do so far in his career. And I think maybe an appropriate place to end, considering how much Russia was talked about during this election, is to talk about the famous Russian liquor, vodka. Because Trump had a vodka, and its story is something I delved into earlier this year. And I think that in a funny way, it's one of the products that sticks in my mind, because what he did is he surrounded himself. He picked a person to work with who basically didn't have experience launching a product like Trump Vodka. And this was a fellow who had recently sort of done a failed startup with Britney Spears, of all people. And what Trump did by signing on with this man who was going to market Trump Vodka is they then picked a distiller in the Netherlands. And that distiller also didn't have experience. And then they started branding it in the United States. And it was just before the financial crisis happened. So, of course, when the crisis happened, vodka stopped selling, and the distillery ended up going bankrupt. So all I can say is it's a little bit disconcerting if you focus on failures like that, because it suggests that Trump has a bad track record of relying on people who are just simply not experienced. And I think that as an American, you have to hope for the best. And maybe you can focus on the successes in Trump's career and hope that he replicates those. And you can hope that his failures, like the bankruptcies in the casinos, or like the strange people who've gotten into 40 Wall Street, or the failed products like Trump Vodka, you hope that somehow he learns a lesson from those and becomes a good public leader nevertheless.
All right, here's to hoping that Trump's United States of America will be better than his vodka. Max Abelson, Wall Street reporter for Bloomberg News. Thank you so much, Max.
Truly my pleasure. Thank you.
This report was brought to you by DW.